On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
There is a lot to discuss in today's papers with Ilona Duffy and John O'Brien. So we'll have a quick look through the stories making the front pages. We'll start with the Sunday Times aviation crisis as Aer Lingus service folds. Opposition parties have blamed the government for the growing crisis in the aviation sector after Aer Lingus's regional service collapsed with the loss of 480 jobs, many of them in Ireland. Aer Lingus Regional abruptly ceased operations yesterday morning after Stobart Air, the franchise operator, announced that it was going into liquidation. This left the travel plans of thousands in chaos and led to criticism of the government's recovery roadmap for the aviation industry, and in particular the use of antigen tests as well. More about which I'm sure we'll discuss at some point in the next hour or so. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times today, Sinn Féin has moved into a strong lead over the two main government parties in the latest opinion poll by Behaviour and Attitudes for the Sunday Times, just weeks ahead of the expected polling day in the Dublin Bay South by-election. Now, you might remember that the last time there was a poll conducted by Behaviour and Attitudes, it was published only 3 weeks ago. At that point, there were only 2 points between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael. Now, it's 10 points. Sinn Féin up 4 points to 34 inside the last 3 weeks. Fine Gael down 4 points to 24. And that certainly, if it translates into anything in Dublin, and if it just the previous balance between those two parties, could very much mean that seat in Dublin Bay South very much up for grabs. The front page photograph on the Sunday Times this morning is very similar to the photograph that you will have seen in lots of front pages this morning. There's different configurations of it. Some of them show medical attention being administered. Some of them show the partner of Christian Eriksen. A lot of them just otherwise show Simon Kjær, the Danish captain, and the other players looking very traumatised as treatment is administered to their teammate Christian Eriksen yesterday when he collapsed 40 minutes into their Euro 2020 match against Finland. As you were hearing in the news headlines at 11 o'clock, thankfully Christian Eriksen now stable in hospital and has been communicating with the Danish Football Association. He's also been in contact with other players. In fact, the Danish state broadcaster yesterday reported that Eriksen had spoken to his teammates before they decided to continue that match, in which they were beaten by 1-0. The front page of the Business Post: Varadkar to push for income tax cuts despite Fianna Fáil concerns. Leo Varadkar is pushing for a package of tax cuts for workers in the forthcoming budget. It gets earlier every year, really, doesn't it? Despite concerns from Fianna Fáil and the financial watchdog about the potential €2 billion cost. Now, the Programme for Government commits the government to examine increasing tax bans and credits in the October budget so that any wage increases earned by workers will not be clawed back by the tax system. In fact, I think there was talk about increasing the higher tax cut-off point to €50,000 based on its versus the current 35,000 or so. The Fiscal Advisory Council has warned that implementing this plan could result in tax receipts being up to €2 billion a year lower by 2025, and it says the proposal was not included in the government's recent stability programme update. And that all comes amid ongoing concern about a potential fall of €2 billion or more in state revenue as a result of those global corporate tax changes that we were talking about. Also on the front page of the Business Post this morning, bulk leasing social homes significantly favours institutional funds and it leaves councils with no substantial economic benefits, the government has been warned by Eurostat. This is the EU's statistics agency. It says that the practice of leasing social homes as opposed to buying them outright has almost completely de-risked development costs, and funds then end up enjoying most of the rewards of the deals. It also added that councils assume nearly all of the risk in the leases but ultimately don't own any asset then at the end. And when we were talking about Stobart Air just a moment ago with the loss of 480 jobs as that firm enters liquidation, more grim news for the aviation sector on the front of the Business Post this morning. Lufthansa Technique, the aircraft maintenance and repair business, is carrying out a strategic review of its Shannon operations, which could result in the business being sold or closed down. That German firm employs over 500 people at the Shannon facility, which makes it one of the larger employers in the Midwest region. And finally for now, the Sunday Independent, again, a photograph of some of the Danish teammates tending to Christian Eriksen just after his collapse yesterday during that Euro 2020 game, and there's an extensive piece written about that. We have some comments from the Taoiseach, who says he's going to meet the Attorney General to discuss how the government can deal with the ongoing issue of defective blocks resulting in thousands of homes crumbling in County Donegal. The main story on the front of the Sunday Independent: variant fears now threaten to derail the opening. Government is increasingly concerned at the threat posed by the Delta variant of COVID-19 ahead of the scheduled further reopening of the country in July. A major effort has been planned to get as many people as possible fully vaccinated this month to provide better protection against the powerful Indian variant. The evidence available is that a single dose of vaccine does not necessarily provide enough safeguards against that variant. Government sources this weekend saying that the threat of the Delta variant was not placing the further reopening at risk at this stage, but that it could do if the virus takes off. A source says, we are in a race against time to get as many people fully vaccinated here before Delta takes off. Which is very similar to some of the front page stories that we've seen in the British papers today, where they're very much now talking about a race against time and trying to delay the final reopening of many things in England, which was originally planned for June the 21st, trying to buy themselves more time to make a little bit more headway in their vaccination programme. Join the studio to discuss everything in this morning's papers by John O'Brennan, who's the Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration at Maynooth University, and by Dr. Ilona Duffy, who's a GP in Monaghan, a Medical Director of the North East Doctor on Call Service. Ilona, before we discuss things that are in the papers, again, it's very difficult to overlook all of those photographs. They're all there in one configuration, another, of Christian Eriksen and his collapse during that Euro 2020 game. It does call to mind the urgency, not only of making sure that there are defibrillators everywhere, but also that people know how to use them.
Absolutely. I think he's a lucky guy. Perhaps if this had happened on a street somewhere, he wouldn't have survived. So it kind of shows the importance of, yes, having defibrillators and maintaining those and knowing where they are. And I think we have a good kind of network of that and apps that allow you to find them. But we also need to have first responders. And we do, again, have a network of first responders. But I think it has to go more than that. We need to start having general teaching in our schools, probably, because, you know, you kind of think of TY year. What a brilliant year to start doing things like this, that every student is kind of educated on how to give CPR, how to use a defibrillator, so that this is something that anybody can use if they see somebody in a collapse. And I suppose it's back to the simple things, ABC, airway, breathing, circulation, and then start pushing on somebody's chest. And if people know how to do that that early, that literally starting in that first minute, you can help bring somebody back.
Yeah, we had Conor Miley, who's a three-time All-Ireland winner, who was speaking on News Talk Breakfast with Maura Chesney-Cally this morning, and he was talking about the push that there is to make sure that people do have access to defibrillators, to make sure that they are fully charged. It brings to mind the death of Cormac McAnallan, a former Tyrone footballer, whose death prompted a major rollout of defibrillators. Do you get the sense that maybe a lot of the momentum about that has dissolved away, that there was this urgency to make sure that there was always one only within a couple of minutes drive wherever anyone might need to be, but that over time maybe some of the attention about making sure that you know how to use it and also making sure that the defibrillator remains charged has also ebbed away a bit?
Well, remains charged and also remains safe, because we've heard of incidents where they've been taken off the walls and kind of battered and ruined and removed. So we've got to make sure that they're safeguarded, I suppose, somewhere properly, that there's a camera also watching them. Mm. But, you know, that initial fear, if you see somebody collapsed, even for me as a doctor, I mean, your heart starts pumping yourself. So it's actually making people know that, even forget running for the defibrillator, send somebody else for that. Immediately check, are they breathing? Mm. Have they a heartbeat? Can you feel a pulse in the neck? And if you can't, then start doing chest compressions, because that's the first thing to do. Mm. Send somebody else off to get the defibrillator and ring 999.
John O'Brien, I know that you were watching the match last night, as was I, when all of this suddenly unfurled. It was remarkable, the poise and the sense of springing to action that we saw from Christian Eriksen's Danish teammates, the way in which they almost kind of understood that there was a job to be done on several fronts and the way they hopped to it.
Yeah, well, I think it's been a great start to the tournament in football terms. Italy played fantastically well against Turkey, Belgium brilliant in beating Russia. Mm. But we saw the best and worst of football yesterday. The worst was undoubtedly the Russian fans booing the Belgian team because they dared to take a knee before the game. And they were duly rewarded with Lukaku, black Belgian man, scoring the opening goal and a second goal. But on the other side, you also saw Scandinavian rivalry, which runs really, really deep, being completely put aside. You saw the Finnish fans chanting in support of Christian Eriksen. And of course, as you said, his teammates rallying behind him as well. And in fact, on social media, you could see the extraordinary concern that was being expressed worldwide about this. It genuinely was a global kind of moment.
What did you make of it as a televisual moment? Because there's been a lot of criticism about the way in which the TV broadcast director cut to pictures not only of the players looking very distressed, but also cut to pictures, and again, there are some of those on the front pages today, of Christian Eriksen's partner, who was obviously highly distressed on the sidelines. And of course, the broadcast feed can't show him, you know, receiving his medical attention, nor would it be appropriate to. But they sensed, a lot of people seem to get the impression that they were showing things that just really didn't need to be shown.
I think it's very difficult for broadcasters in this kind of situation. The only time that I can ever remember it happening was in Britain with the Bolton player,
Fabrice Muamba.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just not something that you expect to happen. So I'm really, there's no almanac for it, you know, if you're a broadcaster and you're reacting in real time and having to take those kind of crucial decisions. I think it's very easy in retrospect to criticize people for having to make those decisions in those terrible circumstances.
Sure. The news from the Danish Football Association this morning is that Christian Eriksen again is stable in the hospital, that he's continues to be hospitalized for further examination. A statement this morning says the team and staff of the national team has received crisis assistance and they will continue to be there for each other after yesterday's incident. They would also like to thank everyone for the heartfelt greetings to Christian Eriksen from fans, players, the royal families in Denmark and England, of course, the previous player with Tottenham Hotspur. So very well remembered by a lot of people in England, international clubs and associations. They encourage everyone to send their greetings to the Danish FA, where they will make sure that they are all passed on to Christian and his family. It does raise an analogous point, Ilona, about whether many people are fully trained in CPR or would know what to do. I mean, you mentioned chest compressions there. I don't think many people would immediately know or have a toolkit in their minds about what exactly you are to do in these circumstances.
No, I absolutely agree. They don't. And again, that the first initial kind of what do I do? What should I do? Mm. So I suppose calling 999, we have a brilliant emergency service here. And often they will talk somebody through and tell them how to do it. And I think one of the kind of the marketing kind of things that had been done was, you know, how fast to do the chest compressions and that really the BG song Staying Alive, going to the beat of that. So it's simple things like that, that people don't have to think how many should I be doing before I try to offer a breath in the mouth or should I even have to do that? And really, we now know that it's the chest compressions to just keep circulating blood. Mm. That's what you've got to do, and calling for assistance and get as many other people involved in helping you with it. But mobile phones are probably also the biggest thing, because now, you know, you think back in the old days, somebody would have had to leave the scene to go and look for a phone. Mm. Everybody's got a phone, can put it in loudspeaker and get help and assistance. But again, let's start looking. Let's see it as something that we will start teaching in our schools, working right the way up, because if we start in our schools, then ultimately every adult in a few years will know how to do this.
Yeah, that mobile phone point is a very important one. Actually, I don't think many people would have immediately crossed that line, but I suppose if you can just call 999 or 112, that they can talk you through whatever you need to do while also having your hands available to administer treatment. Obviously, everyone will hope that Christian Eriksen makes a full recovery. If there's any more information along those lines while we're on air this lunchtime, we will of course bring it to you. In the meantime, there is an awful lot written in today's papers, particularly in light of the ongoing G7 summit in Cornwall, about the Northern Ireland Protocol and about exactly how this sort of ongoing impasse is going to be resolved. I again regret that I had to use the phrase sausage war just before the promo at 11 o'clock, but that is how a lot of this has been framed. If you're not fully up to speed with the details of the sausage war, basically what is now proposing to happen is that a grace period which was being enforced to allow Northern Ireland supermarkets bypass some of the checks on meat products is about to expire. There is some talk of that prospectively being extended unilaterally by Great Britain. Micheál Martin was interviewed by Sky's David Blevins this morning on the Trevor Phillips programme. Let's have a little listen to what he had to say about the prospect of the UK extending that unilaterally.
I think it'll be very problematic, because it's not about sausages per se. It really is about the fact that an agreement had been entered into not too long ago, signed off by the British government with the European Union, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, including the withdrawal agreement and the protocol. And that creates, if just consistent unilateral deviation from that agreement, that clearly undermines the broader relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom, which is in nobody's interest. And therefore, that's why the UK with the EU have to work very hard now in the coming weeks. I know the European Union are anxious to resolve this and want to resolve it, but they need to see a similar reciprocity from the UK side.
So highly problematic, says the Taoiseach, if the UK does extend that that sausage clause unilaterally. I'm sorry, there's no other sort of shorthand way to put it. John O'Brien, what is at stake here?
Well, clearly there's a huge amount at stake for Northern Ireland, for the island of Ireland and for British-Irish relations, as well as for EU-UK relations. But I think increasingly what we're dealing with and what the evidence shows, both for internally within Britain and its domestic politics and the relationship with the EU, is we're dealing with a state that's become almost a rogue state as our neighbour and as an interlocutor. Think about this. Since Boris Johnson came to office in summer of 2019, they prorogued Parliament. They threatened and went ahead with unilateral deviation, which is what the Taoiseach called it, implementation of things that lie completely outside of the protocol when we actually have structures and institutions that can manage disagreements. So the big, big problem has been for a long time that the European Union just does not trust the interlocutors in London. Lord Frost is a particular problem because he is a hardliner, and most of the Brexit negotiation now is going through him. And there's this kind of constant provocation, this constant undermining of the protocol, so that instead of working together, and actually in the background, negotiators have been working quietly. At the beginning of the year, for example, there were about 25 areas where there was disagreement. That's come down to about four. Probably the most important one is SPS checks. But there is nothing, in my view, that cannot be resolved in the structures that have been provided by the joint agreement, by the joint committee.
In the way you've described the UK there as something of a rogue state, and you can certainly make that argument that they've signed up to various international obligations and now they're suddenly breaking away from them again. You could also make the case that the UK has been banging on the door looking for the structures set up by the protocol to try and sort out some of these problems. And they would say that the EU is being intransigent because no matter how many times they try to bring something to the table, they never get a fair hearing.
This is completely untrue. We never stopped talking about the detail of Brexit from 2016 onwards. The protocol was negotiated. It was renegotiated. The EU compromised very significantly by offering the UK the opportunity to remain in the customs union single market. None of these problems would have emerged if that was the case. They now claim that these problems that have emerged have been completely unanticipated. But that's entirely untrue. If you want to go back and read Tony Connolly's blog, for example, over the last 4 years, every single Saturday, all of these complications and details, they knew exactly what they were signing, Gavin. The problem is that these chancers and spivs are governing more or less on a week-to-week basis and entirely on the basis of domestic politics rather than anything else. And this is the fundamental problem we've got. The breach of trust has been so significant that we may be at a point where the EU, and I can tell you patience has rapidly run out, is going to impose tariffs on Britain in a trade war that Britain cannot possibly win simply on the grounds of scale. The European Union dwarfs it.
Do you think that that view of the British as, in your words, chancers and spivs is shared at the heart of Brussels and Strasbourg? Because I'd imagine if it is, then any good faith that you might need to drag a solution over the line is not really going to be there from square one.
This is what makes it so extraordinary. When I was growing up, whatever the nature of Northern Ireland conflict, Britain had a reputation as a place that was well governed, you know, where the rule of law was sacrosanct. All that is out the window now completely. We have a media system that's been completely captured by Tory interests. We have a level of corruption, which is evident in, for example, the contracts related to PPE and all kinds of things. That's unprecedented. We have government ministers breaking the ministerial code on a regular basis without any consequences. In addition,
it's remarkable how few consequences there were. Michael Gove was found to have broken the ministerial code on Friday morning. He was at a press conference in Fermanagh at Friday lunchtime and nobody brought it up.
Exactly. This has been normalised. And to me, it's very, very similar to what's happened in places like Hungary and in Poland. Constant attacks on any of the institutions of the state that might offer opposition. And at the same time, this deepening of corruption that really does threaten the future of Britain, I think, in myriad ways.
You don't portray a very rosy picture of things going on in Whitehall, I must say. Before we take a little listen to what Dominic Raab had to say on Sky News this morning, Ilona, you're based in Monaghan, you're looking over the border. Is there any sense in your part of the world that the protocol has managed to put paid to all the concerns that we had, or are people still looking over the shoulders a little bit with a bit of anxiety about what's coming down the line?
I think there's still quite a bit of anxiety because obviously, you know, it's simple things like I have a family member who took up a job in the north and had moved to Ireland but hasn't official residency in Ireland, so had to actually get a visa to be allowed to work in the north. So, you know, all of these little things, and for people who are travelling from one side of the border to another, for those who have businesses that straddle the border, it is continuing to create difficulties. But I suppose the interesting thing is, I remember being on this show a couple of months ago and it was all about daffodil bulbs not being able to be brought in. And here we are with sausages. So how do you get the public behind you? You pick something simple like that, that, you know, there we are, sausages, the staple of the English breakfast, the Irish breakfast.
The Ulster
Ulster fry, and people thinking they won't be able to have sausages. Of course they'll have sausages. Sausages are made in Northern Ireland. Sausages are made in the South. You know, there'll always be sausages. But you gain that anger and you gain that momentum by picking something simple that people can relate to.
It's funny how little things could sort of be held up as real exemplars of where all of this is going. Let's have a little listen to what Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, also had to say on Sky News this morning. He was responding to a piece in today's Sunday Telegraph wherein it was alleged that Emmanuel Macron did not recognise Northern Ireland as being part of the UK. Here's what Dominic Raab had to say in reply.
We've seen a very lopsided approach to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is supposed to protect all communities in Northern Ireland, not just the EU equities, but also Article 6, you'll be familiar with it, the free flow of trade and goods between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. That hasn't happened. Fully one in five of all of the EU checks and controls to protect its border from Central and Eastern Europe through around to the south of the continent up to Northern Ireland, one in five takes place in Northern Ireland. That cannot be right. So what we want is a more proportionate, flexible approach. If Micheál Martin is willing to press the Commission on that, fantastic. We want tensions eased. We want a flexible, pragmatic approach. What we cannot have is both the Northern Ireland Protocol being applied in a very lopsided way or the Good Friday Agreement being undermined as a result of it.
And speaking of the Good Friday Agreement being undermined, there is also a statement this morning from the new DUP leader, Edwin Poots, who says that Macron does not understand the basics, let alone the finer details. He has written to the President of France this morning and he has attached a copy of the Belfast Agreement with the relevant section about Northern Ireland's constitutional status highlighted. Mr. Poots said, and I'm reading from a DUP statement this morning, Emmanuel Macron's suggestion, John is already rolling his eyes, this will be good. Emmanuel Macron's suggestion that Northern Ireland is not part of the United Kingdom is offensive and demands a statement from the French administration which recognises Northern Ireland's constitutional status. This also exposes the ignorance which lies at the heart of the UK. They seem blind to the destruction the protocol has caused to the Belfast Agreement. It's 5 years since the referendum. Northern Ireland has been centre stage for most of that time, yet the most powerful man in one of the most powerful EU countries still doesn't realise that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. It's incredible. Key leaders in the European Union clearly do not even understand the basics, let alone the finer details. It's time for the government, he means the British government, to stop talking about fixes to the protocol and get on with taking the necessary steps to remove it.
Well, what they're doing, of course, is misrepresenting what Macron actually said. What he said was, and what he pointed to was, the jurisdictional difference between Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom.
I know that nuance comes across in some of the reporting, because basically the argument was made, the Prime Minister said to Macron, the Prime Minister being Boris Johnson, how would you like it if French courts stopped you moving Toulouse sausages to Paris? It's always sausages. And he replied that it wasn't a good comparison because Paris and Toulouse are both part of the same country, to which the PM retorted Northern Ireland and Britain are part of the same country as well.
Well, let's not forget that Boris Johnson himself was the very man who said that the problem of the border in Ireland really wasn't a problem. It was just like the border between two boroughs in London. Mm. Remember that?
Yeah.
Not only do they have no credibility on these things, they will take something small and relatively insignificant like this. They'll use their allies in the right-wing media ecosystem to blow these issues up. And the process of misrepresentation goes on and on. And it has, of course, it has a wonderful domestic advantage for them that they're able to burnish their support domestically in the UK. But it's at the cost of Britain's reputation globally. Mm. That's a reputation, in my view, that has been extraordinarily damaged and continues to be damaged by this kind of play acting and pantomime performance.
There's a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think Dale somebody Carnegie. Needs to send a copy.
Paul on Twitter is saying that, by the way, there are far more chancers and spivs running Ireland than the UK, which is possibly a commonly held argument as well. I do need to take a commercial break, but very briefly before I do, Ilona, a lot has been pointed out and observed in the last couple of days that for there to be so much discussion about Northern Ireland and Cornwall at the G7 this week, that there was no representative of Northern Ireland. There's no one who's ever lived in Northern Ireland, and people will feel perhaps rightly frustrated that Northern Ireland is being discussed in the abstract without any frontline experience in the room of people who live it there.
Perhaps, but then that discussion has already taken place. So, you know, that's only going to be revisiting old ground, and I don't think it's necessary, to be honest.
Sorry, John, go ahead.
The most important thing that happened this week, I think, was the report about the American démarche to the UK the previous week. And remember, That happened in a context where Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, had met Simon Coveney at Shannon Airport for 2 hours. All of this took place kind of away from the headlines, but it was hugely important. And whatever the mood music during the G7 itself, I think the Americans made it very, very clear privately to the United Kingdom that there was a significant cost if they continued to go down this route of dissing the protocol and potentially casting it aside.
Well, the Northern Ireland Protocol is one issue which is common on a lot of the front pages this morning. Another one is the concern about the Delta variant and the threat that it may pose to the reopening both sides of the Irish Sea. We have a tweet in on the Record NT as our hashtag this morning. Someone reckons that the Macron error was actually just a simple issue of being lost in translation, because Emmanuel Macron may have been referring to the word pays, as in the country, in French. And we're pointing out that Scotland could arguably be a different pay to the to England, and the UK is made up of four different pays or entities: the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And Boris just took advantage of that point because he speaks French quite well, which is a reasonable point. 53106 for your text on the Record NT is the hashtag on Twitter. We're going to talk about the Delta variant in just a minute, but before we get to that, the opinion poll conducted by Behaviour and Attitudes for today's Sunday Times is quite striking, and we're still waiting for a geographical breakdown of it. But John, to your mind, should we read very much into the idea that the gap between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael has gone from 2 points to 10 in just 3 weeks?
Yeah, there's a discernible trend there. Doesn't matter which way you cut it. I saw some Fianna Fáil people last night trying to make the best of it, saying, well, government support is still up there around 50%. But
48% between the three government parties.
There is now 10 points between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin lead by 10 points. It's 14 points back to Fianna Fáil. So there is, I think, striking evidence that the housing issue in particular is one that's really resonating with people. And the government parties have been playing into Sinn Féin's hands by obfuscating, by failing to do anything of a radical kind that might tackle the different iterations of the housing problem. So there's no doubt Sinn Féin is making hay. And it is not inconceivable within a couple of years we will see Sinn Féin leading an administration in Northern Ireland and in Dublin. So, I mean, our politics is on the cusp of very, very profound change. I'm not sure people realise just how profound it might be.
The reason why I mentioned the regional breakdown is because they haven't yet published one for this poll, but in the poll that was published 3 months ago, 3 weeks ago rather, when they did publish the geographical breakdown, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin were level pegging in Dublin. Now, Sinn Féin won Dublin in the last general election, but it will be very interesting to see exactly how that geographically breaks down, because if there was, once again, a coherent and solid Sinn Féin lead in Dublin, it would mean that the Dublin Bay South by-election, albeit in Fine Gael heartland, would not be a dead cert by any means.
I think this is one of the reasons, Gavin, that Fine Gael have been really, really heavily present on the ground in that constituency. You can see it literally every day with senior party figures out campaigning with James Gagan. It is, I think, a real litmus test of where we're at now. Sinn Féin have a very high-profile candidate in Lynn Boylan, who's very well known nationally. And I think we are going to get a sense of where we are in national politics, as well as obviously in Dublin.
Obviously, it would be the first electoral test for anybody since the pandemic broke out, and it would be a chance to offer something of a verdict on that as well. Alona, before we do move on, any thoughts on the poll?
Well, I think we're kind of getting back to normal business again. And throughout the pandemic, I suppose there was that sense of, you know, the government are doing it for us and keeping us safe and managing things. And now we're starting to see talk of the pop payments being reduced, phased out. We're seeing people getting back to normal life, worrying about how we're going to pay the enormous bills we're going to have after the COVID pandemic. So I think on the ground, you sense this sense of just disenchantment and unhappiness and anxiety amongst people. And I think that's always reflected in a vote against the government. So I think Sinn Féin are getting that bounce, and whether or not it'll stay as high as that, I don't feel it will.
So let's talk about the Delta variant, which is the dominant topic on the front page of the Sunday Independent. Talk about how it may end up being something of an inhibition towards reopening of the rest of society. We know that in England, they are now preparing to announce a delay in their reopening. Scotland and Wales have already announced that they're going to hold off on the major reopening on June the 21st because they are concerned about the shortage of people who have had two doses of the various vaccines that you might need to have full protection of that. We have a tweet in from Liam who says, why are we being threatened with delay to our lockdown in tandem with the UK? We're way behind on their current freedoms and it's not equivalent. And also, we're more protected by virtue of our vaccination rollout because we're not as reliant on single dose AstraZeneca as the UK is. Alona.
So the big concern, I suppose, is that the UK were the ones we were looking to and seeing their vaccines be rolled out so fast to see the opening up. But now we're seeing the Delta variant become the predominant virus present. And one of the articles actually talks about the numbers doubling every 4 days. So they're now at the highest rates of COVID since February, you know, in the middle of the last kind of surge. So the real concern is that this absolutely is spreading faster. So it's a very virulent, very contagious form of the virus. And as we know, that unless you've had your two doses of the vaccine, you can't be really deem yourself as safe from serious illness with it. And even with that, it's still not providing the same protection. All of the vaccines still don't have the same level of protection against it as they did against the other variants. So this is a huge concern. We're here in Ireland, so far so good. We've only, I think, 126 cases, but we know that's an underestimate of it because we're not actually doing kind of the genetic sequencing of the viruses on all tests that are being done and all positive tests that are coming in. So we can probably know that it's higher than that, and we're going to have that little delay before we start seeing it, because there is a lag time between somebody becoming infected, then becoming symptomatic, and then being tested. So I think the concern is that as we continue to open up, we always knew we would see our numbers rise, but it was always hoped that that would be contained and that it would be okay because people were vaccinated.
But they're barely rising at all. That we've had this continual, you know, reasonably aggressive up until now reopening of society. A lot of people would like if it had gone quicker, but we've had these very constant iterations where every 2 or 3 weeks there is always something material which is reopened again. And it doesn't seem to have made any difference at all to the case numbers, which would suggest that modelling wise things have gone fairly all right, and that maybe we're coming from such a low base that there perhaps might not be so much to fear from a new Delta variant. Because right now, I know the figures are, as you said, a couple of weeks behind, but if we only know about 120 odd cases or so, it doesn't strike you as being this national threat that might derail national plans.
I think because we still have the limit on travel in and out of the country, and especially in, so we're not seeing maybe as much as we might see if we start opening up, and if we start seeing the vaccine passports and people doing more travel, then absolutely we will see not only this variant, but probably other variants coming into the country. So can we manage? I think once we know that we're vaccinating more and more people, and as we're all aware, most of the high-risk people should be vaccinated at this stage, so we should not see the similar rise in hospital admissions and deaths that we saw previously. So I think it's about doing it in tandem. And that was the hope in the UK, that, OK, the Delta variant was there, it was spreading, but that they were continuing to bang out the vaccines and therefore they continue to be able to open up things. But they are starting to see a rise in hospital admissions there as well, because I suppose if you're getting high numbers, you're still going to get some people needing hospital. Some people will get sick. So should we stop what we're doing? No, at the moment, I don't think so. But I think we will be watching and learning closely from the UK and how they're handling it.
There has been, and I don't even want to invite you, John, to talk about how the UK found itself vulnerable because they declined to call off Indian travel in pursuit of a trade deal. But let's not get down that road too far. But I wonder, do you assess that we should be in any way concerned given the relatively no numbers of the Delta variant in Ireland up till now, bearing in mind there's open travel between Britain and the North and then downwards?
Yeah, I think one thing we probably should do is to go back and look at the pattern that emerged in between November and January, because there it was the Kent variant that became predominant in the UK. And then within about 3 to 4 weeks, it became predominant in Ireland. Now, if that is the pattern, we may be 3 or 4 weeks behind the UK. So by the end of the month, we could be seeing the kind of increase that Ilona referred to in the UK, the doubling of infections. But I think both governments will be looking critically at the level of hospitalization, because that's the key indicator about transmissibility. Against that, of course, we're vaccinating now at a rapid rate almost everywhere. But one of the other issues we face, and it's referred to in some of the newspapers, Elaine Byrne has a very good piece on vaccine nationalism.
Yes.
She points out that in the Sunday Business Post that we are not going to be free of this, and we're going to face the kind of further variants that Ilona mentioned. Unless we vaccinate the rest of the world. So the Biden commitment this week that the United States is going to provide another 500 million doses of the virus
of the vaccine
from Pfizer, that was very significant. I think the EU has to follow up on that. We are not going to be able to reopen travel where we have huge number of countries around the world where there's only 1 or 2% of people who are vaccinated. So we have, it's in our interest, both in public health terms and economically, to ensure that the rest of the world vaccination catches up very significantly.
On that travel note alone, and again, we don't have someone from the aviation sector, and it's probably too nuanced a discussion to get too much into now, but obviously it's very difficult not to draw links between the collapse of Stobart Air and the ongoing inhibitions that there is for international travel for people leaving the Republic. We seem to be increasingly ploughing a lonely furrow in demanding a PCR test from everyone coming into the state and not making do with an antigen test. In your mind, medically speaking, should we be satisfied with people coming into Ireland if they can present an antigen test simply to say, I'm not infectious right now? Ought that be good enough?
We have to go on the data, and I suppose I'm kind of following what Neffet are going to be advising us on this. And really, that is that when you have that test, it's just at that single moment in time, and that as you walk through an airport, as you know, do your shopping, to get ready for your travel, you may become infected during that time. So we really haven't had the ability to see how it's working, because obviously with the cyber attack, we haven't been getting the reports on the numbers. And it would be interesting to see how many people coming into the country are testing positive, especially with the 5-day test, when they get tested 5 days afterwards, and those who are in the mandatory quarantine. So we've missed out on learning from all of that data, and I think that's something that's probably slowing down making some of the decisions. But again, as time moves on, you know, will we have to have these tests if you're fully vaccinated? The reality is that if you're fully vaccinated, it protects you, but you still, there is the potential for you to be infectious. And we know that as time goes on, studies
quite
are showing.
Quite slight though, isn't it?
It's slight, but again, it's still there. And I suppose if you're on a plane with people, who knows? That's the thing. But again, I don't want to be kind of putting a dampener on things. We're all hoping things are going to open up. We all have family we want to see who are abroad. We all want to see things open up so people can have holidays, and sectors like the aviation industry and other industries that are attached to it have a chance to reopen and get those jobs back up and running.
There is, of course, more to discuss just about the short-term hospitalisation effects of COVID. There's also long COVID, and we'll come to that again in a couple of minutes, because there's an interesting piece in the Sunday Times today. Before I go to a break, another comment on Twitter. Devastating listening to the likes of Dominic Raab and Edwin Poots this morning. Irish and British relations have gone back 30 years. That two Irish politicians, Coveney and Varadkar, were threatened with harm by Ulster loyalists who voted for Brexit has largely gone unreported or not commented upon. We were talking about COVID and whether the Delta variant poses any meaningful threat to the reopening of society, certainly in this side of the Irish Sea, just before the break. There was one lingering question, though, which I did want to get Alona's thoughts on, which is the fact that many regular News Talk listeners will have heard Luke O'Neill on the Pat Kenny show at regular times over the last few months, making the case for what he's calling mix and match vaccination. The idea that particularly now, as we are concerned about those who've only received one AstraZeneca dose and the protection that they have from the Delta variant, whether it would make sense to, instead of waiting for a second AstraZeneca dose to be made available, instead to just give them a Pfizer dose if it were to be available, and whether that might just be, in fact, better than waiting for a second AstraZeneca dose. Alona, your thoughts on that?
Well, this has come up in discussion before, and actually in Canada, as a means of trying to roll out the vaccine faster, they've advised people to get a second dose no matter what, you know, so get your Moderna, get your Pfizer if your first dose has been AstraZeneca, because as people may be aware, up until recently it was 12 weeks and initially it was actually 16 weeks between the two AstraZeneca doses, which meant that a group of people kind of from the over 60s were basically 60 to 70s were left with 12 weeks, and you know, that's been now reduced to 8 weeks. But it has meant that people younger than them and theoretically healthier than them were actually being fully vaccinated and protected much earlier than they were. So I think Luke O'Neill's argument really is, you know, it's about protecting everybody, and you need your two doses if you're to have protection against the Delta variant especially. And also he's quoting some data that's suggesting that actually having one dose of each seems to create much much stronger response. That's kind of, I suppose, there are ongoing studies on that, and we're still waiting on data to come out on that. But maybe it's something that definitely some of the immunologists are saying that they feel would work well. But to date, the HSE guidance on it is that you will get two of the same dose.
On the flip side, and just before we move on to, again, that G7 banter that listeners were so cryptically teased just when we came back from the break there, there is a great piece today in the Sunday Times by Julianne Corr about the whole question of long COVID. And sometimes I wonder whether that's ever factored into the arithmetic, that we make a lot of decisions based on the impact that a new spread would have simply on hospital numbers. And that becomes the main metric that you look at things, and not necessarily about whether people who do get ill, not necessarily ill enough to be hospitalised, but whether when they become ill, they become ill for months or potentially for years afterwards.
Well, you're completely right. It's something that's not been factored in because it really can't be counted. It's very hard to objectively state who has long COVID and who doesn't, because the symptoms are so different. But we know that in the UK, they definitely are quoting quite large numbers with it. And again, it's not necessarily associated with the severity of the disease that you had when you got COVID. So you could have very mild symptoms and end up with long COVID. I suppose it is reflected in the fact that a number of the hospitals in Ireland and two of the private hospitals have set up long COVID clinics because they're seeing that demand. And I think it's very hard because if it was one set of symptoms and you knew you could tick box it, yes, you have it, yes, you don't. But it varies from everything from chestiness to shortness of breath to palpitations to just fatigue to loss of smell to loss of taste. There's a myriad of symptoms that go with it.
To play devil's advocate for a minute, though, could you argue that maybe a lot of that aren't so much symptoms of the virus so much as just something that takes a lot out of you, and it just takes you a while to work back up your physical fitness? That if you get a really bad dose of COVID, of course you're going to have some respiratory distress for a little while. Could you argue that it's not so much long COVID as maybe a lack of fitness, if that you're struggling to get your breath back, or if that you're still struggling for weeks or months afterwards?
No, because it seems to be actually greater numbers or percentage wise in younger people and those who are very fit. So what they're now feeling is that it's probably more a response your body has to the virus. So it may be an autoimmune type response that you develop individually. So it's not necessarily the virus itself in the active disease, but it's how your body reacts to it and gives you these chronic long-term symptoms.
The BBC is reporting, by the way, in the last few minutes that the Elysee Palace has confirmed the nature of that exchange between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron over the sausages. They say that Macron was making a point about Northern Ireland not being in the same single geographic area as the rest of the UK, not necessarily the same country. Yeah, you know, see what we make of that. Apparently there's a final press conference coming in the G7 in the next little while, which does beg an interesting question to John O'Brien, because again, there's a lot written in the G7, not only about the Northern Ireland Protocol, but also corporate tax changes and the approach to climate. I've seen a very pertinent question put on Twitter this morning, which was, when was the last time that the G7 or the G8 in its previous incarnation ever actually agreed anything that had a concrete difference to how the world worked afterwards?
I think the tweeter, the implication of the tweet is absolutely right, that in the usual scheme of things, the G7 is not that important beyond the opportunity for leaders to meet each other, to get to know each other, to build or maintain relationships. But this time, I think it is different. Like, the agreement on corporate tax is really, really significant, potentially. It's going to move to the OECD now. We probably will get an agreement by October. And if it is introduced, it's a game changer globally.
But is an agreement in principle really all that valuable? When we even saw last week, after there was agreement among the G7 nations to implement this 15% rate, that Rishi Sunak was immediately looking for an exemption for the City of London, which is pretty much all of the UK, you'd think.
Oh yeah, it was fantastic to watch. Yeah. On Sunday, the Brits were proclaiming that they had brokered this extraordinary agreement. Yeah. And within days, they're resiling from it because of British exceptionalism. But the other thing I think, Gavin, though, was important was Biden yesterday. Like, Biden, this is his first trip as president overseas. And I think he came determined to rebuild the transatlantic relationship. Specifically yesterday in comments, you know, they were captured. He was in conversation with Macron. And he talked about NATO and the European Union as hugely important to the United States. And that's in the context of what's going on globally. Because Biden, I think, over time, he used to be very sanguine about China. Now he sees China as America's main adversary in the world. And I think he was using the G7 to try and use it as a sort of bulwark against the kind of things that China is doing in its own part of the world and globally. So I think this G7 may actually turn out to be different to others previously.
Leaders unite to tell China the West is back. It was one of the headlines in the Sunday Times piece by Tim Shipman, their political editor in the UK. Speaking of the G7 and how it previously used to be known as the G8, if the purpose of it was to build something of a bulwark against China, what can we read into, or what should we expect to see when Joe Biden has his bilateral with Vladimir Putin?
Oh, I think that's going to be hugely interesting, given that the last time this happened, it was very controversial, that meeting between, and the press conference between Trump and Putin. Here, I think...
Was that the one where he handed over football?
Yes.
I forget which one of the many ones it was, but I think he handed over like a World Cup football. It was to do with the US being the next World Cup host, and it turns out that there was some sort of surveillance device in football. Kelsey Breeze.
It was, and of course, it was also the press conference where he failed to defend the American security institutions when he was asked a question about whether Russia had actually been involved in the US election. I think it's very difficult to tell. I mean, the relationship is really, really difficult, very reminiscent, I think, of the worst of the Cold War years in the early 1980s. Mm. I don't think we're going to see any significant breakthroughs on arms control or anything like that. Biden knows Putin because, of course, he was vice president for 8 years. Mm. He's described him in the past as a killer, and that's a description that Putin himself hasn't kind of recoiled from. I think he kind of revels in that tough man image. So I think it will be really, really interesting to watch the sort of semantics as much as anything else in that meeting in Geneva.
Is it an occasion for bridge building, or is it an occasion for a stare off?
There's no bridge building possible with killers. And let's be clear what the Putin regime is. Mm. It is an extreme kleptocratic tyranny. And it's become more and more tyrannical. Look at the way that Alexei Navalny's party, for example, has just been completely banned. They're throwing journalists into jail to beat the band. Mm. You can't do anything with an adversary like this except close it off as much as possible with your allies globally.
Between the tyranny and the chancers and spivs, I'd really like to know what John really thinks about some of these things. I'm afraid that we're out of time, so we can't pick his brain anymore. We'll have to let him go. John O'Brien, Jean Monnet Professor for European Integration at Maynooth University, and Ilona Duffy, Medical Director of the Northeast Doctor on Call Service. Thank you both very much for coming in to me this morning.